Hoping that George Saunders is going to appear from a room in LA now. George.
Your wish is granted.
How are you?
Good, Tim. How are you? Have a busy day?
Yeah, no, we have. George, one of the things we started talking about, or one of the threads through the day, was the whole business of matter inclining to life and life inclining to consciousness. And it just seems to me that you've given quite a lot of thought outside of your extraordinary fiction to the whole business and the function of storytelling with and for human beings. What role do you think art, more specifically storytelling, has? Why are we so drawn to it?
Well, I think it's kind of Darwinian. I think that it helps us, it sort of yanks us out of our preset mode, which is to believe that, you know, we're the main story. You know, George is born, the world starts revolving around George. Anything that's good for me is good. And then also the idea of our own kind of permanence, you know, that the sense that the world will end when we do. So when we're doing storytelling, whether we're writing a story or receiving one, I think it's kind of a mechanical, almost like an exercise in becoming aware of our own projections. So in other words, most times I'm just solidly me, kind of trapped in this invisible cage that is myself. And when I read, say, Tolstoy, through this sort of magical tricks that he can do, I'm briefly somebody else. I'm an invented person. I'm having their sympathies and their biases sometimes and their passions. I think that's good for us in terms of long-term survival, because the self thing we create is actually a delusion. And as long as we reside in it, we're kind of setting ourselves up for a big crash. Maybe with death, that would be the big crash. But also, I think hundreds of times a day, when we too closely identify with self, we have little frictions, because essentially it's not really true that the self is central and permanent.
And it's interesting because some of today we've been talking about how comfortably we avoid important truths. The whole business of humankind cannot bear very much reality. But you're saying almost that alongside that, almost underneath it, continuously, there's also a kind of leaning towards or a longing for something that is more, that is sense-checking that. That's almost bringing it back into line through, for instance, storytelling, reading and writing.
I think that we feel, I mean, just speaking for myself, all the times when, during the course of a day, when I'm trapped in that self, and for me, the symptoms of that are anxiety or irritation, you know, self-righteousness, those moments are not pleasant. Now, we might not even notice them. You know, we might be unaware enough that we don't notice. But they are painful, and they do kind of, they stand between us and sort of bliss, I guess, or joy. So, I mean, I don't want to claim too much for stories. I think it's almost just like a slight, you know, it's kind of like doing curls for your biceps. I mean, you know, you do it just because it's better than not doing it. It's corrective. So I think a little connection with reading and writing every day is just a kind of a form of maybe secular prayer, where you just get lightly reminded of what the actual reality is, you know. And in that way, you do have, I think, in a certain way, a more honest conduit to life as it shows up, you know.
One of a story of yours that particularly has always speaks to me is a short story in 10th of December called Puppy, in which... Mm. And I'm not quite sure why. I think the story consistently surprises me and subverts my expectations of what various characters within it will do. But you're presenting to me parallel and really conflicting perspectives on goodness, love, and what I think people's understanding of one another. And I just wondered if you could say a bit about that story and where it came from and what it means to you.
Sure. I mean, I think you've hit on it. One of the things that fiction does, and I wrote a book recently called A Swim in the Pond in the Rain, which is just a analysis of Russian stories. And Chekhov especially does a certain move where he causes the reader to feel that character one is the good person, and we feel sympathy for and connection with character one. And then there'll be something that happens that makes us think, oh, wait, maybe I've jumped in too soon, and your allegiance starts to shift. Chekhov can do this 3 or 4 times in the story, and by the end, what's really happened is you just become aware of your tendency towards facile judgment. You know, how quickly we want to say this is good, this is bad, thrown with the good and thereby eradicate the bad. So in the story Puppy, there are two women about the same age. One is, I guess, to be understood as a slightly more affluent kind of, I wouldn't say she's an elitist, but she's educated and she has a lot of aspirations. And she's gone to buy a dog from a second woman who's, we understand, to be much more working class. And she has some real challenges with her son. So the process of writing that story was one of seeing my own allegiances flip back and forth. At first, I wrote the story based on an experience I had where we drove by a house. We were on a nice outing with our daughters in our new car and feeling very, you know, upper middle class or middle something. And we were having a great day and we flew by this house. And in the yard, there was a little boy who had some kind of harness on. And he was chained to the fence. And we flew by so quickly, and I thought, what did I just see that? And didn't do anything, just went on, you know. And that image stayed with me. So for the first part of the story, I identified very strongly with the middle class woman. And then just because of the way stories are, when I started to write the second section from the point of view of the working class woman, suddenly the working class part of me step forward to represent her, the part who, when our kids were little, often felt hamstrung by a lack of money and by a lack of choices. So the whole story is just those two voices from within my head sort of going back and forth. And in the end, I loved them both, you know, with reservations. And that might be, you know, the mantra for every work of fiction. We love them both, you know, we love everybody, but with reservations. And so I think a lot of people read that story, and one of the debates that people have in classes when they teach that story is, where are your allegiances page to page? And I think what we find is that they shift, and in the end, there's not a resolution. You're just left, I think, temporarily sort of in love with both of them, with reservations.
And of course, in Lincoln and the Bardo, there's an entire spray of these characters at all points of continuity around morality, and we do come to love them all and feel affinity for them all. But I just wonder, is it too tall a claim? So your piece in The Guardian where you suggested that through storytelling, you might even get to a point where you could understand, I think for that piece it was the those that invaded the Capitol building, however long ago that was, a couple of years, you could recognise the impulses in other individuals that gave rise to some pretty horrific or near horrific acts. Is that a tall claim?
I think it's a great aspiration. I don't see any harm in stretching ourselves to do that. And you know, the base assumption is if Sam is feeling something, it's on a continuum with my feelings. In other words, now this may not be true at the very, very ends, but I think for the great mass of our experiences, if you're feeling it, I felt a version of it. If you are feeling dark and angry, I felt it. You know, there was the great Israeli writer, Eck Carrot. Both his parents were Holocaust survivors. And he came to Syracuse once and gave this beautiful talk. And in there, he said that his, as a child of survivors, he was always feeling that there's something about his parents he didn't understand. So one day he said to his dad, look, I know I could never understand what you went through. And his dad said, nonsense, son. Have you ever been hungry? Yeah. Scared? Oh, yeah. Tired? Yeah. It's just more of that, you know. So that's kind of the assumption, I think, that underlies fiction, that if an emotion exists, it exists everywhere. And the fiction writer's job, in a sense, is to find it within himself or herself slightly exaggerate it maybe or fit it to the purpose being described, leave it on the table, and then hopefully the reader comes along and goes, oh yeah, I have that person within myself. So in a sense, it's kind of this overused phrase, but it's kind of a safe space where if you want to experiment with what it might be like to be insanely murderously jealous, for example, we can do that together. You know, it doesn't hurt. No actual beings are harmed in the course of the story. So I think it's kind of, you know, the optimistic underlying idea is that, yeah, actually we are on a continuum. The human mind is basically the same. If we took our two brains out, God forbid, and put them on the table, they look identical. The processes are very similar. You know, if I say fresh cut grass on a summer day, everybody in the auditorium goes, oh yeah, I know that. So that's kind of the underpinning, I think, of fiction. And for me, it is. Anyway.
It's interesting, isn't it, George? Because very often, I guess, if tall claims are made around fiction making us better people or art making us better people, one, we recognise, don't we, that there are some pretty impressive cultures and societies out there who are well-read and artistically replete, who can behave terribly. But it sounds as though what you're saying is not so much that fiction somehow makes us better people, it makes us recognise the potential awfulness we all contain and are capable of.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, my wife and I just went to Sedona, Arizona, beautiful place, and we hadn't been on a vacation really for a long time. And there was something that happened while we were there that just, it sounds like kind of cliche, but we just came alive a little bit. Just like, oh yeah, of course. You know, there was almost like parts of our brain came alive with that experience. And we're the better for it. You know, now it won't last forever, but it did happen. So I think with art, I do make a lot of big claims for it. I'm getting like a reputation for that. But in my heart, I think, well, if I start with a blank mind and then I read the first 20 pages of Beloved by Toni Morrison, there's an alteration that happens. And it's not different from that trip to Sedona. I'm just sort of suddenly, it's almost like part of me is saying, hey, oh yeah, we're still here. We're still alive. So that's a small effect. And it doesn't last for long, but I think it's an incrementally good thing. And I'm pretty happy to leave it at that, actually. You know, in other words, we know that going for a run is an incrementally good thing, and it's, you know, that's all we have to say about it. So I think it's just enlivening. It's locally enlivening.
George, you've suggested almost that previously that as we age, or well, let's take age out of it, we gravitate more, we incline towards, almost inevitably, towards being kinder. Your view, and I don't know to what extent this view may be informed by your faith as a Buddhist, but that is the way we're headed.
Well, I said that in that speech, and I caught a lot of crap for it over the years because people would say, you don't know my uncle, you know, who's 89. So I do think actually now there's a branch point somehow, and you meet older people who somehow have learned something in there, and they're calm, their energy is less, and they're more open. But you also see the, you know, the opposite. I do think though that as, you know, just from my experience, as your hair goes, your knees go, the body starts to look weird, death becomes more believable, you know, which in turn I think can soften one a bit, you know, you make the same mistakes that have to do with believing intensely in the self. You get angry, you have hubris, you have too much ambition. And after 60, 70, 80 years of life, you start to go, oh, that path isn't very good. So I think there can be a softening in the body, but I'm sure the other thing can happen too.
And does your Buddhist faith shape that sensibility?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the Buddhism, I'm a very infrequent, you're sort of, you know, inconstant practitioner. But the one thing I've really taken from that is just the idea that, for sure, the mind makes the world. You know, when you have a fever, the world sucks. And then suddenly the fever goes away and the world is beautiful. And so what I've learned from both Buddhism and writing is that the mind isn't static. It's incredibly malleable. And maybe the work of a lifetime is just to always be messing with your mind so that it moves slightly in the direction of love and kindness and openness and patience, I think I'm not sure that I used to think there would be one day when it would just click and I would always be kind, happy, patient. That doesn't seem to be happening. So I'm kind of beginning that very adult work, I guess, of saying, well, give me 6%. You know, give me 1% better. Let me lose my temper and then more quickly get back to baseline. Those small kind of victories that actually I'm starting to think are not very small after all.
And from your perspective, reading is one means towards refining that sensibility and pushing back against some of our more baser instincts, or calling them into question,
yes.
Shall we say?
Yes. I mean, the thing that I notice when I'm writing a story and when I'm reading one and when I'm, say, meditating or just feeling good is that the ruminating mind gets a little quieter. You know, the part of the mind that's saying, I'm George, I reign supreme, or I'm George, I'm a terrible mess, that part gets a little quiet. And for me, when I'm editing a story, it's a bit like I would imagine like rock climbing or something. You're so attentive to the task at hand that monkey mind has to be a little bit quiet. So that's something I've just noticed in all the things that I really like in life, that state is what gets produced. You know, that kind of sense where you're not really thinking in concepts, which means you're not really constructing judgments, which also means you're somehow softening the bonds of self. You know, when there isn't that voice in your head telling you who you are, then suddenly, you're not in sway to the delusion quite as much. So I've come to really crave writing just because it takes me out of that monkey mind state for an hour or two. And which to me is very similar to like prayer or meditation.
And I really love your phrase around tenderizing your relationship to your characters when you write them. Is that
yeah,
something you can
that, say? That's a natural result of editing, because in the first pass you've written a cartoonish idiot that everyone can hate together. Well, if you're writing a literary story, that doesn't quite hold up. People feel that that's not honest. So then in the many revisions, you're just really, you know, you're open-mindedly looking at the characters and you're saying, is there anything that I need to know about you? You know, am I representing you unfairly? And the character will say, yes, thank you for asking. I had a difficult childhood. Would you put that in your story? You know, you do that. Suddenly the character that started out as a villain, he might still be behaving villainously, but now you've got an extra layer of understanding. So if you do this as beautifully as say Chekhov does, by the end, you know, your judgment as a reader has just been suspended, which is a really beautiful state to be in for a couple of seconds. You know, a few years ago, I did a nonfiction piece where I went down to the Mexican border and I drove the whole border from east to west over a period of about 2 weeks. And I went into the story with all kinds of ideas, of course. The trip just knocked all the ideas out of me. You see so many contradictory things. So I got to the very end and I'm in San Diego, and there's a place there where you can be at the ocean, and there's the border thing literally runs into the ocean. So at one point I just stepped onto the other side into Mexico and came back and thought it was very clever. And I was amazed because nobody stopped me. So I'm walking back along the beach and suddenly these two incredibly handsome border patrol guys on horses come trotting up like a Marlboro commercial. And they say, hey, sir, you're aware you were just in Mexico and we could arrest you. Oh, yeah, yeah. But they said, well, we're not going to arrest you, but what are you doing? So we started talking about my piece. And I had some ideas that I wanted to put in the story. I expressed it to them. And these two guys who knew everything about the border took every idea apart. That's incorrect. That's contradictory. That doesn't work. And then they happily rode off. And my whole idea for the story was just in shambles at my feet. I had literally, after 2 weeks, no idea of what, you know, no political ideas. And it was maybe one of the most alive feelings I've ever had, to have all the data, no conclusions. You know, so I think that's what a good short story can do as well. You know, in the hands of Chekhov or Tolstoy or Grace Paley or Alice Munro, you see what a silly person your judging self is. You know, how inadequate your judging mind is to the actual complexity of life. And instead of being dispiriting, it's kind of enlivening.
George Saunders, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. At least I can be there in person.